we're calling here is Commonwealth of Virginia and Ricky Davis. Ricky Davis case. Sure. Come on over. Morgan, can you make sure everyone signed in because we're running out of case. Okay. You may begin when ready.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir, you have it.
And I am Paul Fritzinger. I'm the Deputy Public Defender in Franklin, Virginia, and I do represent Ricky Davis. I did represent him in his violation hearing that is the subject of this this appeal. And because I represented him in that case, you know, when I did the appeal, I think a lot of times when you're in the case, you have this insulated view. And as I let the case sit and went back and looked at it, it became much more clear to me that the issue wasn't, in my mind, nearly as complicated as I seemed to have made it. Basically, you know, this case is unique in my mind, and in most instances, petitioners or appellants, they're claiming rights that the Commonwealth says they don't have. Well, in this particular case, the appellant's asking to divest himself of a right that the Commonwealth seems to be saying he must exercise. And I think that that is really the crux of the matter here. The question, you know, became, did he have a right to counsel? And I think you have two different avenues that you go at here. One of them is the 14th Amendment due process question, which is a constitutional question. And the courts have said that's a qualified right. Basically, if we look at a Virginia Supreme Court case decided in 2016, Walker versus Forbes, that case speaks to, I believe, just about everything that we have going on in this particular matter. And when I say it's a qualified right in Walker, the Supreme Court said that where a defendant is going to claim that he's not committed the alleged violation, or where the violation is uncontested, or a matter of public record, but he has some issue of justification or mitigation, or the reasons are complex or otherwise difficult.
Here, he pretty much said he was guilty of the probation violation.
He had, Mr. Davis obviously had issue with the allegations made by the probation officer and felt that he had some issues of mitigation or justification. And I believe that he stated some of those in that this was the same probation officer that had violated him on a previous occasion for the exact same reason. And the reason was that she had asked him for his keys and he wouldn't give her his keys. And he felt at that point they were his personal property and she had no right to ask him for his personal property. He wasn't doing anything wrong with him. And he felt that this was either a justification or a mitigation in the case. So he did have those issues. And I think based on the 14th Amendment due process question or analysis, I think he would have had the right to counsel. However, it seems
that right, wasn't it?
Right. However, it seems, you know, in these cases, because the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply, the default position would be no right to counsel. So, in the purest sense, Mr. Davis is in court before the court without counsel. He is pro se to start off. In these cases, then we have to ask, does he have a right to counsel? Well, under the 14th Amendment, I think he would have.
But the analysis, and I appreciate your argument, but the analysis becomes circular because based upon the status that he was claiming, which I'm assuming was some sort of sovereign citizen status, that it becomes circular because if he does not claim to abide by the rules of the court, then how can he claim that he is being denied any constitutional rights that exist? It becomes circular, doesn't it?
I don't think that was ever established, Judge.
Well, he said that he was operating in some sort of term
sovereigner.
He mentioned the word sovereigner.
Yeah.
He did, and he said he was standing on his right. However,
what he did say was he didn't want pro se counsel. He didn't want to be
represented.
He didn't want to represent himself because he didn't want to be bound by the rules attendant to self-representation. He had this
improper persona, is what he said.
Improper persona, correct, Judge.
Which meant, as Judge Alston said, he wasn't prepared to follow the rules of self-representation.
And I understand where that comes from. However, as I said, you know, this when you look at it from a black and white record, you don't get exactly the the tenor of what was going on in the courtroom. And I happened to have been standing right beside Mr. Davis at the time. And basically, the way this was going between the judge and Mr. Davis, it was a very fast and furious conversation that was going on. It's not as neatly laid out as it is
record. But I think what is clear is that the judge thought that your client, right or wrong, was undermining the dignity of the court by operating the way that he was, right or wrong.
Well, right or wrong, okay. I think, in my view, I think the court more so just didn't want to be bothered with it. But that's my opinion, and that's, you know, that's...
Maybe fair.
You know, he felt, of course, it would be much more orderly if I were conducting the hearing. However, I think that...
Well, isn't it fair to say the court was getting a little bit tired of your client interrupting the court and the witnesses? And was concerned that your client was not able to represent himself, and had made it plain that he didn't want to be pro se because he didn't want to be held to the same standard that a lawyer would be held.
Well, I think that's like three questions. So let me do those. First of all, when the court decided that he couldn't represent himself, there had been no witnesses yet. So it couldn't have been based on the fact that he was interrupting witnesses.
I meant the judge more than the witnesses.
Oh, okay, the judge. Second, when Mr. Davis said, I don't want to represent myself pro se, I want to go improper persona, I don't want to be held to a legal standard, the court said, well, you've just withdrawn your motion then. And Mr. Davis went, wait a minute, there's been a misunderstanding. But the court never asked what the misunderstanding was, never asked Mr. Davis to clear that up. And if Mr. Davis had been able to clear that up, if the court had actually done an inquiry to find out exactly what Mr. Davis meant, then the court might have learned that Mr. Davis did indeed avail himself of the court. A person...
But what is ambiguous, what is ambiguous about saying, Your Honor, I am not asking to represent myself pro se? What's ambiguous about that?
Mr. Davis is not...
Explain why he didn't want that to happen.
I'm sorry?
After he said what Judge Alston said, he then explained why he wanted to not be bound by the traditional rules of self-representation.
And then he says, because the court can hold me to a legal position.
Right, and Mr. Davis is not an attorney. So you have to, exactly. And you have to understand, and I'm sure that you do, that when people try to sound more educated than they are, sometimes they're using words they don't even understand. So when he's talking to the court here and trying to, I don't want to be held to a legal position. Well, if you said that to me and I was the judge, I'd be like, what do you mean? This is all a legal position. You're before the court. I don't even know what that means exactly.
But the judge, and I will say this, and it's, I guess it's judicial, take judicial notice of this. I know that at the education seminars that we judges have to go to all the time, there was a specific presentation on sovereign citizens, and judges in the Commonwealth, circuit judges in the Commonwealth, are required to go to those education seminars that we have every May. And the reason why I know that is because I'm on the education committee, and I know that there was a specific section that we had on people who are representing themselves as sovereign citizens or sovereigners or whatever you want to call it. And the understanding that a judge would have is that this person is not going to accord himself consistent with the responsibilities that most of us who are lawyers and, you know, not sovereign citizens would accord themselves. Going to follow the rules, going to agree that the judge has authority and power over him, that other people other than the sheriff have authority over him, and that he's expected to adhere to the rules of court. So then he says, I'm not asking to represent myself pro se so the court can hold me to a legal position. I would think that a judge in this commonwealth would understand what this person is saying, and that is that they don't want to follow the rules because they don't believe the rules apply to them.
But he is, though. I mean, he's availing himself of the rules of the court the whole time. He availed himself of the rules of the court when he was given counsel. He's availing himself of the rules of the court by asking not to have counsel. He was availing himself of the rules of the court. He put himself under the auspices.
So one might say that he's waiving his rights to be a sovereign.
Maybe. But he never claimed to be a sovereign citizen. He never claimed to be a member of that group. I mean, there's nothing in evidence here except for a couple words that he said that would say that that's what he was. He said, I'm just representing myself as a sovereign. Now, we know that when these people are in jail, they talk to each other. And it's very possible that when he was deciding for himself to represent himself, he spoke to someone who was a sovereign citizen, and they were like, hey, just tell the court this, and they'll have to let you represent yourself. We don't know that. He never claimed, though, that he was a sovereign citizen.
But would the judge necessarily, by allowing this exchange to take place, abuse his discretion by acceding to the course that he did?
I think he does. I definitely think he does, because regardless of whether he had the right to counsel or didn't have the right to counsel, Virginia has pretty much said that the default is no counsel in a probation violation. So if the man walks up and says, I want the default, I want no counsel, I think it's error for the court to say, no, you have to have counsel. Because I would point the court to one particular case that I think had a good quote in it, Van Sant v. Gondels, where this was actually a habeas corpus proceeding under the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District, Virginia, Alexandria Division. In this particular case, the court notes, it says, Judge Russell simply refused to acknowledge petitioner's repeated request to represent himself. Judge Russell's attempt to force the petitioner to accept representation of a lawyer he did not want is directly contrary to Ferretta. Now, I know that Ferretta doesn't apply here necessarily, but what the court is saying, what we can take from that is, this judge is saying a court can't force a person to have counsel. And that's my whole question.
Did you cite the Van Sant case for this?
Van Sant is, I'm sorry, Judge, just one second. 596 F. Sup. 484.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Say that, 596 F. Sup.
F. Sup.
484.
Thank you. And I think, Judge, that's the case. You can't tell a person, if a person has a right to counsel, then I think it flows that they necessarily have a right to waive that right. And I don't really think, aside from the court deciding that it's voluntary, that it's intelligent, and
cogent.
Well, there are cases, and I don't have the site right here in front of me, that say a person doesn't have to have a certain level of education.
I'm talking about a cogent indication that he does not want to be represented.
I think that was clear. He said it five times, I think, during, no, you don't understand. I'm not waiving my right. I don't want to be represented by counsel. He kept saying he wanted to represent himself. That's clear waiver. And at that point, I think the judge must, as long as it's voluntary, as long as it's intelligent, he knows what he's doing by waiving counsel, regardless of what his argument's going to be. I mean, you talk about the sovereign citizen thing, though. How can we say that a person who adheres to a certain political theory then doesn't get the same rights as everyone else?
Let me ask you this, and I agree with you on that. But let me ask you this. If a person, we all agree that the ability to represent yourself is sacrosanct, and we're supposed to adhere to that as long as certain requirements can be made or met for a person to represent himself.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those requirements is the ability to conduct a hearing. Not necessarily to the level of a lawyer, but willing to conduct a hearing consistent with the rules of court. Your client said he wasn't going to do that.
He didn't say that he wouldn't be civil.
No, civil is not the standard. Your client indicated that he was unwilling to accord himself consistent with the rules that would apply to a lawyer.
And when the judge remarked, you know, alluded to that, what was his reply? No, judge, there's been a misunderstanding. But the judge just cut him off right there and said, no, you've withdrawn. That's it. Okay. And I don't think the judge can do that.
You're actually used up your rebuttal time, but we'll see how much time your opponent colleague takes, and maybe you can
use
a little bit of his time.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth, and we are asking the court to affirm Mr. Davis's revocation because the court did not commit reversible error.
What would you suggest, counsel, is the standard of review in this case?
I believe that it's subject to abuse of discretion.
So we would have to find that the trial judge abused his discretion, Judge O'Hare abused his discretion, but not exceeding to Mr. Davis's request.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that especially in the context of this revocation proceeding that there's a lot of deference that's given to trial courts in determining whether a waiver of the right to counsel is voluntarily and intelligently made. On the merits question, I do believe that the court did not commit reversible error in finding that Mr. Davis had not voluntarily and intelligently.
You would agree, though, that an individual is entitled to represent himself in a probation violation hearing.
I believe that the court has the discretion to allow an individual to represent themselves if they make the necessary showing, but I don't think that there's a Sixth Amendment right
to
self-representation.
No right to the way I understand the law, there's no right to counsel in a probation violation case. The Ferretta principles don't apply.
That's true. There is a statutory right to counsel, and there's a potential 14th Amendment right to counsel. I don't think that it was present in this case, but under Gagnon versus Scarpelli and Walker versus Forbes, there's potentially a 14th Amendment right to counsel in a revocation. It depends on whether there is a facial claim or a potential that the individual was not guilty. So,
do you believe that under the circumstances of this case and the factual background of this case that Mr. Davis made out a case to represent himself? If we were to apply the traditional principles regarding right to counsel and right to waive counsel.
Well, again, Your Honor, I'm not sure that I understand the question completely. If we were to apply the Sixth Amendment to this,
yes.
No, I don't think that he made the necessary showing that he was voluntarily and intelligently waiving his right to counsel. I don't think that he evinced an understanding or an acceptance of the rules that he would have to follow to be able to avail himself even of the Sixth Amendment right to self-representation. But that's really not the question here because the Sixth Amendment doesn't apply. The central error that Davis has made here in his argument is arguing that the court can't force someone to accept counsel. But the Supreme Court of the United States said otherwise in Martinez versus the California Court of Appeal. In that case, the Supreme Court narrowed Ferretta significantly to trial situations where an individual was on trial in the first instance and enjoyed the right of the presumption of innocence and all the other rights attendant under the Sixth Amendment. The Supreme Court of the United States pointed out that that someone's position changes a lot when they go to a direct appeal. They're held under a presumptively valid judgment at that point, and the state's interest in having efficient court procedures and having able representation for appellants takes precedence at that point, and the state can force someone to accept counsel at appeal. And it's the Commonwealth's position that revocation proceedings are very similar to a direct appeal for the purposes of self-representation rights. So the Commonwealth would not agree that there is an automatic right of self-representation that accompanies.
Is there under Section 19.2-157, are there any cases which, to the extent that, say, Ferretta and those other cases talk about how this determination is to be made, been stated under Virginia law to your knowledge, other than stating that it needs to be voluntary and intelligent? Has there been any refinement of that standard?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. And I pointed that out in brief, that it's not a settled question as to whether there's a right to, whether Ferretta extends to revocation proceedings, but I laid out the case for why this court, if it reaches the merits on this, should reject the idea that there is a Ferretta right in revocation proceedings, principally on the logic of Martinez versus Court of Appeal, because I mean that case lays out all the reasons why Ferretta's logic and Ferretta's analysis is really peculiar to a trial setting, and how the historical analysis that's present in Ferretta doesn't apply in direct appeals, also doesn't apply in revocation proceedings.
If you were the individual who were responsible for developing the analytical framework for 19.2-157 and 19.2-160, provide any illumination as to how a trial court is to determine whether something is voluntary and intelligent? Should we use a Miranda Fifth Amendment analysis, or what type of analysis would you suggest?
I think that you would probably use the same sort of voluntary and intelligent language that we've used in the context of other waivable rights. Mm-hmm. And then you'd have to leave a lot of it to the discretion of the trier of fact to determine whether...
Well, isn't that have the potential of being dangerous, because we're going to have all kinds of inconsistent determinations? One trial judge might say one thing, one trial judge needs to say another, and then we have inconsistent application of the law throughout the Commonwealth. Shouldn't this court be in the position of telling trial judges what they need to do?
Standing here before you, Your Honor, I think that any reasonable standard that you could set for voluntary and intelligent waiver was not cleared by Davis. He evinced a clear unwillingness to go along with the rules of court for the purpose of the hearing. And so I don't know that you need to reach that question.
We'd have to be careful to suggest that any person who claims to be a sovereign or a sovereign citizen cannot voluntarily and intelligently waive the 14th Amendment rights that he may enjoy under the constitutional application.
Yes, Your Honor. And the sovereign citizen issue really makes this case, it throws an additional complication into using this case as a vehicle to make generally applicable law about Ferretta and revocations. Because Mr. Davis presented pretty singular facts. I mean, maybe not singular, but he was pretty far out there in the colloquy. If you read it on pages 20 to 21 or wherever in the appendix, that back and forth between the court and Davis, he was extremely combative.
So would you suggest that instead of actually tackling the merits of this case, Mr. Davis had in effect conceded that he was in violation of the terms and conditions of the probation, that we need not reach the determination as to whether or not this was a voluntary and intelligent waiver under 19.2-157 and 160?
Yes, Your Honor. That's one of my fallback positions. Really, I think the best and narrowest grounds for dealing with this appeal would be to hold that Davis's present arguments are barred by the abrobate-reprobate doctrine, because Davis took the position before the trial court that...
Don't get us caught up in that.
Well, I think there's a lot of appeal to the argument, because he took the position before the trial court unambiguously that he was not asking to represent himself pro se, because he didn't want to be held to a legal position or to the same standards as a lawyer. And his position now is that the trial court, despite those representations, should have allowed him to go into a situation where that was exactly what he would have been held to.
Was approbate and reprobate argued before the trial court?
I don't think that it would have to be, Your Honor, because the idea of approbate and reprobate is that his position before the trial court was mutually exclusive with his current position. So he just isn't allowed to take his current position, that the court should have allowed him to represent himself pro se when he was explicitly and unambiguously asking not to be pro se, but to be in his right as a sovereigner before the trial court. So those are mutually inconsistent and successive positions. So I think the approbate-reprobate bar does apply. But at a minimum, I think 5A18 also applies to bar many of his substantive arguments, because he did not develop the same arguments before the trial court and give the trial court the opportunity to rule on the substantive law that he's now presenting to the Court of Appeals. And once his motion was denied, his counsel did not note objections and explain all the relevant law that it's now bringing to the Court of Appeals. So 5A18, even if approbate reprobate doesn't bar his present arguments, I don't think they're preserved under 5A18.
Again, it's circular because he says that he doesn't need to have counsel argue because counsel wasn't representing him, so it would have been his responsibility to actually make the arguments and not his counsel, theoretically.
But then
it becomes circular.
Yes, Your Honor. But then he lost that argument and he's proceeded with this appeal, but he never made the trial court aware of the grounds for why he thought the denial was error. And you note in the record, after the motion is denied, there's nothing more that's said about it by counsel to make a record of objection or anything. This is really the first argument before this court that counsel has made in favor of the motion. And there, you know, if we were faced with a position where Davis had made cogent legal arguments and then counsel carried those on here on appeal, then that may have satisfied 518, but that's not the situation we have here. You had basically an unambiguous claiming of rights as a sovereigner and then an appeal on a different basis, really, and a mutually exclusive basis. So, but on the merits, just to sum up the merits, I think that it's important to separate the potential sources of where a right to self-representation could come from and deal with those separately. So Ferretta does not apply to a revocation hearing because Ferretta is a Sixth Amendment right that's made clear by Martinez, and the revocation proceedings are not subject to the Sixth Amendment. They're not under the Sixth Amendment. So any right to counsel that Davis would have had under the federal Constitution would have had to come from the 14th Amendment. Even if he could establish a right to counsel under Gagnon versus Scarpelli and Walker versus Forbes, that doesn't carry the same concordant right of self-representation. It's not a personal right of self-representation that automatically accompanies a right to counsel. And that is also made clear by Martinez, because the whole issue in Martinez was whether someone could proceed pro se on direct appeal. And the Supreme Court of the United States said, no, the court can force you to accept counsel in this context. So I don't think there's any federal constitutional basis for relief for Davis here. His only basis for relief then would be under the state statutes, and even there you don't have an explicit right to self-representation under the state statutes providing for representation by counsel. There's a procedure that's laid out for how you can waive counsel and how the court has discretion to find whether or not that waiver has been voluntarily and intelligently made, but there is no explicit right of self-representation that's provided for by state law. And so I think that essentially Davis is left asking this court to create a right of self-representation where one does not presently exist for revocation proceedings. And especially given the unique facts of this case and the fact that the court, whatever a reasonable standard would be for voluntarily and intelligently waiving this right to counsel, Davis doesn't need it. So I really don't think that the court needs to reach the merits as to whether the trial court erred. But in the event that it does, and even if the court was to find that the trial court erred in not allowing Davis to represent himself in his right as a sovereigner, I think that this court can find that was harmless error, because Davis showed that for him to take on a greater role in his own defense would only have hurt him. And he didn't have, and the court has already noted, he didn't have a defense to any of the charges. His testimony corroborated most of the material elements of the charges. And, you know, I mean, there were arguments made in mitigation. I think that counsel made them quite ably, that he already had a history with this probation officer, and the trial court heard those and rejected them. And I don't think Davis could have made them better. So for all those reasons, and again, I want to make sure that I'm very clear on that harmless error argument. If the court finds there is a federal constitutional right to self-representation in a revocation hearing, then that's structural error. So we can't get harmless error on that if the court finds that the trial court erred on that.
I think we understand.
But if it's a state, you know, statutory right only, then it would be harmless error. So for all those reasons, the Commonwealth asks that the court would affirm the trial court if there are no further questions.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We'll come down to Greek Council.
All rise.